Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to F This Movie.
Was that supposed to be a Hitchcock impression?
I sounded exactly like him.
That was the best Hitchcock impression for course correcting. I've ever seen.
That's why I'm the Rich Little of the 90s. My name is Patrick Browning, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Hitchcock, not the director, the movie called Hitchcock, by JB.
Yes, Patrick sounds like Hitchcock, and I look like him. Together, we're a formidable pair.
Like I said, you're listening to F This Movie, which you can find online at fthismovie.net. You can find us in the iTunes Store. Leave us a positive review if you like our show in the iTunes Store. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And find us through DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com by clicking on the podcast tab at the top of the page. Thanks to Michael Staley and everybody at DVD Verdict for hosting our show there. And while you're there, browse around, read one of tens of thousands of DVD and Blu-ray reviews, some of which I have written, some of which Eric Asperschlager has written, and click through the Amazon links and support DVD Verdict at the holidays.
And over the holidays, I'll be on the corner of Irving Park and Southport,
yes,
handing out transcripts,
nice,
of our various shows
like
to
that.
The passersby. And really, you cannot avoid F This Movie
you
this
know that,
Christmas season.
You know that Kevin Smith actually did that, published a book, basically, of transcripts of his podcast. So if you hadn't listened to them enough, now you can read them.
Well, having had the honor of attending one of Mr. Smith's shows at the Chicago Theater, and wondering to myself why I had just paid $65 to receive what we used to get for free at Comic-Con, I will be passing up that published opportunity.
Christmas is coming up. Make sure you send all of your gifts to fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Very quickly, speaking of gifts, one of our listeners, loyal listeners named Sal, recently sent me the postcards that were in his Universal box, and that was very generous, Sal, and we love you, and it's my new favorite thing, and thanks.
He's wearing them right now.
I am. It's sort of kind of like a bikini, like think Laugh-In in the early 70s.
When aren't I thinking Laugh-In?
Picture a grotesquely fat Goldie Hawn with a goatee wearing nothing but Universal Monsters postcards. And that's your nightmare before this Christmas.
Sock it to me. We're going to talk about Hitchcock momentarily, and the movie's not getting a very wide release, so a lot of you who are listening maybe haven't had a chance to see it. We're not really going to be spoiling it, except to say that he directs Psycho. Spoiler, Hitchcock directs Psycho. It's not necessarily the kind of movie you can spoil, but I just want everybody to listen to this show in particular. Even if you haven't seen the movie, don't wait to see the movie to listen to us talk about Hitchcock.
Yes, spoiler alert, he becomes very rich and famous.
But before we talk about Hitchcock, JB, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I gotta tell you, yesterday, against my better judgment, I allowed my better half to drag me to the movie theater to see The Hobbit.
Yes.
Part one.
Right, of three.
Yes, and I think I'm down for the record that I'm not a big fan of fantasy films, and I was not the biggest fan of the original Lord of the Rings trilogy. I know this puts me in movie jail, but I went to see it because our local cinema not only has it in IMAX, yay, but in 3D, major boo. But this new high frame rate thing.
48 frames per second, which I think only like 5% of the theaters showing it. It opened on like four, I didn't do the math. It opened on 4,000 something screens, which is like a record for December. And I think maybe around 400 in the country are showing it.
I wish that they had made it available 2D high frame rate.
Me too, but also not really.
And now that I've seen it in high frame rate, which I want to just discuss briefly.
Yeah, well, first talk about the movie and then talk
okay.
about the
presentation. The next time I go to the theater, I'm going to sneak into a 2D screening just to see a couple minutes of it to compare.
This is my dilemma because I have not yet seen The Hobbit. I did not have a chance to see it this weekend. I really want to see it. I don't want to see it twice. However, the first time I see it, I want it to just be 2D celluloid, 24 frames a second, because that, I feel like, gives the movie the best chance. But I'm fascinated by this 48 frames per second, so then I want to go see it a second time.
I let that bring a canteen and one of those little pocket urinals, because it's a long time.
Yeah.
And you might not want to see it twice, but again, what got me to the theater was high frame rate, yeah. And again, I really liked it.
Okay.
I really did.
Wow.
I was surprised by how much I liked it.
I am surprised as well.
And I thought it was very entertaining. It had far less of the stuff that I don't like and a lot more of the stuff that I like. We've talked about this endlessly. When all of the little elves and Gandalf and Bilbo start running away.
Hobbits.
No,
you're right.
13 of them
are not elves, they're dwarves.
13 of them are dwarves.
Yes.
The elves are the guy from The Matrix and Kate Blanchett.
Right.
And there's also trolls and orcs. Really, it's like they should give you a program, like a scorecard, you could keep them straight. When everyone starts running in a long shot, and it becomes a video game, I check out. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot less of that. One of the things I liked was, and I don't know if we've ever talked about this, in Peter Jackson's King Kong, there's a sequence where King Kong battles this dinosaur, and at one point they're sort of falling through the air, and they get wrapped up in some rope or something, and it becomes this crazy batshit aerial ballet that just won't stop, and it's like Buster Keaton, and it's like, holy shit, this is the greatest! There's a couple elements that in some of the CGI stuff in The Hobbit. It's sort of that someone's worked out the physics of it, and it's very elegant, and it's very like a Roadrunner cartoon, like Looney Tunes, like, oh, someone worked this out. But I find that it's the more human moments. There's a really nice speech that Bilbo has at the end that I thought was really well done. For what it's worth, the film really does Joseph Campbell really well, that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very taken with it. I went expecting to not like it, and I really liked it a lot.
That's great.
But, so I can still have something to bitch about. When we left the theater, the one thing I just kept thinking of was John Carter. And that I enjoyed John Carter. It's not a great film, but it's a good film.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a rousing boy's adventure tale well told.
Yes.
And that's exactly what I thought of The Hobbit. Now, why is The Hobbit going to break box office records and John Carter is the leper of the... It makes no sense. But why can't people just go and judge?
Because the failure of John Carter, and I think we'll end up talking about this in a couple of weeks,
yes,
had nothing to do with the movie. I mean, the movie has problems and some deeper than maybe just on the surface, but that narrative was spelled out very early. The Hobbit is beloved.
Right.
It's from this beloved series that, you know, everybody loves Lord of the Rings, and this is part of that. And John Carter, people were actively rooting for it to fail, to the point where now best and worst lists are coming out, and more than one critic, including the critic from Time Magazine, I take that back. Time Magazine named a different movie. Entertainment Weekly named John Carter the worst movie of the year.
Not demonstrably.
There's
not
just
true.
No way.
There's no way that that's
no way that that's true.
And again, maybe this is too much to hope for, but I, as we get older, and as I continue to deal with all the F this movie people in this community that we love, I want the movie and not the stink.
Right.
I'm really tired of the stink.
Yes.
So that being said, I would recommend The Hobbit, especially if you have children. This is the type of film that children should see. The messages underlying this film about comradeship and the nature of the adventure and how you always want to choose the adventure over staying home and what it means to align yourself with someone else and things like that, the nature of good and evil, all great stuff for little kids. That being said, the high frame rate is something. I've read a lot of reviews, and some people really hate it.
Yeah.
But it speaks to the way our minds interpret the way information is being fed to you, because the first few minutes that you're watching, it looks like really good live theater on videotape.
Okay.
And it's very unforgiving because it is very detailed. and it seems like they've had to adjust the lighting for it. After a while, you get used to it. There's some scenes where you're sort of reminded again, oh, this is in this new format. But I don't watch it and think, this is the death of film, this is horrible, this is making me sick to my stomach, all these different reactions that I've heard. What it reminded me of is the first time I got a high-definition television and noticed until they got the makeup right on the local news, high-def TV really showed you how ugly some people are. Especially like if it's a man on the street interview in the news, it's like, oh, skin tone, real skin tones. Don't. This is, Jackson's a pioneer, and this is something that's brand new, and clearly different directors can do different things with it, but again, I went expecting to hate, and I thought, this is viable. If you don't like it, go see it in the regular. I like the fact that we have a choice. Regular IMAX. High frame rate, regular frame rate. 2D, 3D. I don't know why everyone's bitching.
Well, it's a little out of control, the number of ways that you have to see a movie, especially when it's taking up extra real estate, because now you have four options of seeing the same movie.
And ultimately, that's why I think they did it, because I remember when Coke introduced New Coke, and everyone said that was the worst business decision ever made. But after a couple months, when they reintroduced regular Coke, Coke Classic, to the cheers of people who had become addicted to the original formula like heroin, what they did was they doubled their shelf space, because New Coke didn't go away. They kept it.
Right.
This is a way to get on more screens.
I guess. I think a lot of people are reacting to, maybe out of, not paranoia, but their fear that, like, uh-oh, is this really what the future is supposed to be? I think their concern is, what if I no longer have the choice to see it at 24 frames a second?
And it does look less film-like.
Right.
It looks like something else. But maybe I'm in a cheerful mood for the holidays? I don't know.
The thing that nobody mentioned in all the reviews, because again, I'm back and forth, I really want to see what this looks like, but I don't want to see it in the 48 frames per second. The thing that nobody talks about, though, is the 3D, the fact that you're seeing it in 3D and through these glasses, that you don't feel like that stepped on the clarity of the high frame rate image?
No. Okay. In fact, I can only wonder how clear
really?
It would
okay.
be
okay.
without the glasses. Because even with the glasses, it was like, this is crazy nuts. In fact, there's moments where you almost feel like they've played with the speed.
Yeah.
And I even read one review that suggested that, you'd have to help me here, the actor who plays Bilbo.
Martin Freeman?
Yeah. That he was very aware of the new technology and scaled his performance.
Interesting.
Because he knew how intrusive and unforgiving it was, that he deliberately downplayed.
Interesting.
Has
no one seen a performance from him before? That's sort of his default mode.
That's true, looking back at other things he's played. Yeah. I keep forgetting he was in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like in the film.
I really want to see it, and now I want to see it way more, knowing that a doubter such as yourself actually really liked it, because I like the Lord of the Rings movies, so...
It's long.
Yeah. Well, so are those.
But I'm able to downshift.
Yeah.
This is going to be an evening's entertainment. One thing I noticed that I'm so glad I remember to bring up, the IMAX theater, which is large,
yeah.
where we live, was packed. People have a real hard time with a three-hour movie.
Which is weird because every movie is 3 hours now.
But
summer blockbusters,
and maybe I've either
pictures.
Avoided them or I've been so enmeshed in the film I haven't
Everything
noticed.
3 hours.
But this, sitting through The Hobbit, people were up, people were down, people were up, people were down. It was really distracting.
Well, you know what I think it is, too, is you get an audience for this that doesn't necessarily always go to the movies.
Yes.
They don't know what to expect. They don't maybe have the same endurance as you. So, yeah, there was somebody was telling me a story about there were people in line for The Hobbit. You know, you had to line up to get into the theater before the show starts. And there was a guy who was very concerned, like, well, what if I have to go buy a Coke? And how will I get a seat? And he couldn't understand this concept that, like, well, you have to either get into the theater, pick your seat, then go buy your Coke, or get out of line right now. Like, he wasn't
grasping.
Because
we're really used to lines for
right,
things, and
right.
maybe people aren't. The other thing I would suggest, and who's going to listen to me, and it's too late now, whatever happened to an intermission?
Sure.
And I know it's long and they want to get more screenings in,
yeah.
but I remember seeing the Barbra Streisand A Star Is Born in its second run, and the local theater that showed it, they added an intermission where there was none. And I would think the theater would like that because you sell more stuff.
Right, right.
The Hobbit needs an intermission, okay. And if you watch the film, there's a perfect spot.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I'm really excited to see it. Touch on this real quick, and then we'll move on. You got to see the prologue for the 9-minute preview of Star Trek.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Into Darkness.
And I'm watching it, and it's pretty terrific.
Yay!
And there's a whole bunch of stuff where if you're a Star Wars fan, I guess
Star Trek?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's
okay.
A crime. If you're a Star Trek fan, I think there's one thing in particular that's driving people nuts because they want to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much 10 minutes of the movie.
Okay.
It's really long. And they show that and oceans of trailers. So I'm thinking we were in the theater for 4 hours. In any case, I was watching the Star Trek preview, and it's so long, and it gives so many things away. I can only hope that they're playing an Indiana Jones, and they're showing us the first 10 minutes.
Sure, sure.
That's gangbusters, because it's like, in fact, there's one sequence in this preview that's a lot like something in Indiana Jones.
Okay.
But I'm hoping that the movie starts like a house on fire, and that's what they just showed us.
Right, right, right.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah, The Dark Knight was kind of the first movie that did that, where before I Am Legend, if you saw that in IMAX, they showed just that opening of The Dark Knight, the bank robbery.
Right.
And that's enough. I mean, like, that looks fantastic. I'll go see that. I was going to go see that anyway.
I remember going to see some Adam Sandler movie just to see the first trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, The Waterboy.
And after the trailer, people walked out.
Yeah, but and they had signs up at the theater, no refunds, I remember. Meet Joe Black was the other movie that showed in front of. Anyway, let's talk about Hitchcock. I'm not going to do my what have you seen lately, because I saw Beasts of Southern Wild,
Well, let's just talk about that for a minute.
Okay.
What did you think of it?
Good. Really interesting. Kind of stuck with me in a way that I didn't expect it to.
And I really give it credit for being unlike any movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, although I struggled, honestly, for maybe too much of the movie. I was distracted by trying to understand the metaphor of the big monsters, you know.
Oh, see, I didn't.
Okay.
For the first half hour, I thought it was a documentary.
Oh, interesting.
I mean,
yeah. Very original, and I'm surprised at how polarizing it is, actually, that a lot of people feel like it's racist, actually. But we'll have to talk about that another time.
Okay, would you recommend it?
I would, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I believe it's out on DVD and Blu-ray now. If you haven't seen it yet, you should definitely see it. The other movie I'll talk about that you haven't seen, I don't think, because everything else I've seen, I think, is stuff that you've already seen, is Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh.
And I was surprised at how much I liked it. I didn't have a huge desire to see it. I was not somebody who grew up playing video games. You don't necessarily need to be versed in video games to appreciate the movie. I think there are some little in-jokes that are for definitely people who know the language of video games and who recognize the characters from maybe the 80s.
Even in the preview, you can tell that they really tried to get this right.
Yeah.
In that I saw video game characters from games my son used to play.
Right. But yeah, I was surprised at how much I liked it, and you can really see the influence of, because while this is a Disney movie, it's not a Pixar movie, but you can really see the influence of Pixar on certain animated movies, how much time they put into developing the characters, that the movie is very character-based. Pixar does story really better than anybody else, but they do characters really well, and this movie I don't think has as good a story, but the characters are really great, and John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman are both really, really good. I think it's worth everybody's time.
Everyone I know who's seen it has really liked it.
Yeah, yeah, really good. I also saw Legend of the Guardians. That's the owl one. Rise of the Guardians.
The one with Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and Jack Frost. The trailer made me want to see that.
The trailer made me not want to see it. The movie's a little better than that trailer, but I thought it had some problems. There's moments where it comes together and you think, man, this is fantastic. They're making basically a superhero movie with just the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and Jack Frost and the Tooth Fairy. And I really thought, I don't want to give anything away. I really thought they were going to just leave like cute kids out of it.
But there are cute kids.
But they don't. And then I was bummed out because I was like, oh, we've seen this a million times.
Where... I was giving them so much credit for stylizing the characters so differently.
Yeah.
And so oddly and giving Santa a Russian accent.
Yeah.
I really kind of like that.
There's moments where it's great and other moments where I think it's problematic. I don't know. Like a lot of animated movies this year. Let's talk about Hitchcock.
Okay.
It's time. The time has come.
So they tried, they were going to open Hitchcock on a couple screens, and when those screens got all these accolades, they were going to open it wide. And the funny thing was, I traveled far afield to see it Thanksgiving weekend, thinking, I'm going to catch it now, but next week it's going to open wide, and then it didn't. The second week, it opened in one more screen.
Yeah.
And then the third week, and it opened on maybe
one more.
Than yeah. It was Lincolnshire.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, something's wrong. Because here's part of the problem. I saw a Thanksgiving weekend with an audience in Evanston that loved it.
Really?
And was patting themselves, this kind of thing, patting themselves on the back for liking it.
There are a lot of moments, and if we spoil some of those, I'm sorry. I will try and talk around them, but... There are a lot of moments that they do these little homages or references yeah. to Hitchcock that, yes, definitely seem designed for people to be impressed with themselves for getting, even though if you know anything about Hitchcock, like, of course you're going to get these things.
Right, and it's what I once called a moron's idea of cleverness. First time we see birds in his office, I think it's two China birds. It's relatively subtle, and you're like, oh, the birds, that would be his next movie. But then they keep doing it.
Oh, boy, do they ever. And honestly, I don't use that expression in my day-to-day life that is trademarked by you. A lot of times in this movie, those were the words that were going through my head. Oh, this is a moron's idea of cleverness.
And actually, they missed out on having a wonderful moment at the end. I think I can spoil this.
Okay.
Oh, well, let's let the cat out of the bag. Don't go see this movie.
Yeah.
Don't go see this movie. This movie enraged me. And my wife kind of liked it.
Really?
And the entire drive home from Evanston, I'm screaming about all the things in the movie that never happened. That never happened. And at the end of the ride, she was like, well, now I don't like it quite as much.
Here's the problem. I could almost buy a movie that tells sort of a fictional account of certain things.
That's where I want to start.
But the movie doesn't want to be that, because it's weirdly stuck in between being sort of a straightforward biopic and being Ed Wood. And Ed Wood is so great, and this movie sometimes wants to be Ed Wood, and then sometimes wants to win Oscars. And
that's the point of comparison, too. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but there are things about which people feel uncomfortable.
Sure.
And Hitchcock was a genius. I firmly believe when it comes to making movies, he was a genius.
Of course.
And genius makes people feel uncomfortable. And it doesn't help that Hitchcock was pretty twisted in real life. Billy Mummy tells a story of something Hitchcock whispered to him once when he was filming an episode of his TV show. And it's like something that you would never... ever. In fact, I just remembered what it was.
Okay.
The shooting went late, and everyone wanted to go home, and everyone's nerves were frazzled, and Mummy kept blowing a line or something, or screwing up, or missing his mark, and Hitchcock bent down and said, little boy, if you miss your mark again, I'm going to nail your feet to the floor. So I'm not going to suggest that Hitchcock didn't have a lot of personal problems. If Tippi Hedren is to be believed, what he put her through on The Birds and Marnie is something no one should ever go through. However, the film we're talking about tonight focuses on Psycho. And Janet Leigh said, never was a problem.
Right.
He was a gentleman. We got along. We had a fun time. There's all these pictures that don't look posed on the set of Tony Perkins and her and Hitchcock yucking it up. And I'm not saying Tippi Hedren is a liar. All I'm saying is there's a whole bunch of stuff about this that could make people feel really uncomfortable. And this film's job is to smooth it over.
Yeah.
To make it into this very comfortable, oh, she was the power behind him.
It also,
they had this very interesting marriage.
Not only can it not decide how it wants to approach the material, it can't even decide what material it wants to approach. So it's this straightforward retelling of the making of Psycho. Or it's a story about how behind every great man, there's an even greater woman. Or it's the story of this marriage that's in trouble and he's jealous of another guy. I mean...
And that's one of the film's biggest problems.
Yikes.
But thinking about it, I was trying to puzzle out the truth that, obviously, I'm not expecting every film based on reality to be a documentary.
Right.
I know that that can't happen.
Right.
And I know that one definition of art is that it's a lie that gets to the truth. And I read several reviews that compared Hitchcock to Ed Wood. So now I'm stuck thinking... Why are the liberties they took with the Ed Wood story okay in my book? Because I love that film, and I think it's Tim Burton's best film.
It is.
And I can look at Hitchcock and say, there is no demonstrable reason that you made the changes that you made in the extent to which you falsified history that I have a big problem with it.
Right.
That I'm not willing to give you leave to do that. Is this just my personal preference, or...
No, I think there's more to it, and I don't think we have enough time to spend on it.
That we're looking at the motivations of the filmmakers.
Right.
Why did Tim Burton and the two screenwriters on Ed Wood choose to go that way, and why did this team choose to go the other way? Because in the grand scheme of things, I don't even think it's the same thing that they did.
No, it's not. It's not. And ultimately, honestly, part of it comes down to, with Ed Wood, it really works. And with Hitchcock, it doesn't. And you can forgive something that works.
And because I saw it with an audience that loved it, it wasn't until later that
I'm
I started
so fascinated
reading.
Fascinated by the fact that they loved it.
Oh, it was a
I watched this movie at home on a screener. And JB was very careful not to tell me his thoughts on the movie at all.
I tried.
Although I could definitely sense the fact that he did not...
At some gathering, like I said, I'm not going to talk about it. And there's a pause, and Patrick said, you hated it. So what do I have to say if I'm hiding the fact that I liked it?
I don't know. You could have surprised me. I was surprised that you loved... that you enjoyed The Hobbit. I disliked the movie almost from the outset because it doesn't even start with Hitchcock. It starts with Ed Gein.
And here's a big problem of the film, and I don't even think this is a spoiler, because none of you should be seeing this. That we start with a sight gag that they borrowed from Psycho 2.
Mm-hmm.
And now...
Which is so great, by the way, in Psycho 2.
Oh, no, that moment's transcendent. And so we get this sort of cheap joke, and now we're looking at the Ed Gein story, and obviously Hitchcock gets interested in the Ed Gein story because it was the basis for Psycho. And so for the rest of the film, we have Ed Gein as this sort of fever dream muse. At one point, Hitchcock is shown on the therapist's couch, and the camera pulls back, and Ed Gein is a psychoanalyst. This makes no sense.
And it's another example of this movie is trying to be eight different things.
And it doesn't work at all. And all you have to do is look at the film and have a brain to know that one of the reasons why Hitchcock may have made Psycho is that Hitchcock had mother problems. And one of the points the film keeps almost making, but never quite, is that Alma was very much his mother. So why don't we have some more overt mother stuff going on in place of Michael Wincott as Ed Gein?
If you're going to do the Ed Gein thing, you have to stick with this idea. The movie has to be about how Hitchcock is driven to make Psycho because he's obsessed with this weird dark thing, and that's what drives him to make Psycho. So the movie does a little bit of that. Then it does some of the mother stuff, but then it also goes out of its way to talk about his motivations for making Psycho being, I have to challenge myself. I want to do something different. I want to do something that people aren't expecting. So we have all these different reasons that the movie is making.
The film even fumbles that because he wants to get back to the way he used to make movies. But again, if you know anything about Hitchcock, he had just made North by Northwest, which was a thunderous success. It made money in bushel baskets. And Hitchcock began to wonder, are they coming for me, or are they coming for adventure and Paramount's push and big stars? And he's making the most commercial films being made at the time, and he honestly thought to himself, would they just come for me? Also, he was seeing low-budget horror films clean up, and he wondered, what if you made a good one?
And I wonder if it's just because I'm a movie fan, but those things interest me so much more than what this movie has on its mind.
And so many of the film's decisions are demented, and on one of the articles I read about it might suggest why, other than the fact that the filmmakers went far afield of anything that would be artistic in any way. Psycho, the film, is owned by Universal Pictures. Universal Pictures did not make this movie.
Right.
I read that the filmmakers were enjoined from using certain things from Psycho as intellectual property. So, except for the shower scene, which is fairly accurate, you'll notice that every time they recreate something from Psycho, it deliberately looks different.
Sure, sure.
That there were things they weren't allowed to copy because Universal would scream
sure.
intellectual property. So that's one of the reasons why things are way off.
When you say the shower scene is fairly accurate, and this is kind of a spoiler, that means that on the shot of Janet Leigh, it was Hitchcock holding the knife, furiously stabbing at her, and making her scream for real?
Let me retrench. Nothing in the film is
I was just, like, that's one of the most iconic scenes in movie history. I'm not sure you can lie about the way that it was shot.
And, see, I have all these notes, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but, because I just want to fall down a hill, and I want it all to pour out of my brain.
Well, there's no way to organize this discussion.
Okay, shower scene.
Yes.
The way it looks in terms of a white shower and Janet Leigh being in it.
Yes, and that's what I thought you meant. I wasn't trying to call you out on saying that. Half of my question was genuine because there were certain things in the movie that I didn't bother to research because I knew that you would know actual history.
Let me give the umbrella phrase for this whole thing.
Okay.
Every time they go with a lie,
yes.
the truth is more interesting.
Right.
Manifestly more interesting.
Right.
But it doesn't fit in their little comfortable masterpiece theater. There's always a woman behind the man.
And that is, I would say, the overall narrative of the movie. But there's not even a single narrative to which they need everything to adhere to justify the lies. You know what I mean? If it was all to try and make it fit into this one little puzzle box, okay. But we've already said they're doing six different things at one time.
And one of the ironies is, and it's a great irony, is that one of the reasons I know so much about this is I've read Stephen Rebello's book, The Making of Psycho. You know, the book the movie is based on.
For the longest time, the title was Alfred Hitchcock and The Making of Psycho. That was the name of this movie.
And they've cheerfully chosen to throw the book over their shoulder. And I'm hoping that those of you who listen to the podcast will just take this on faith. But in what I'm about to discuss, here are my sources. Janet Leigh wrote a book. Janet Leigh wrote an entire book. It's something. You should read it. About her experiences making Psycho. So many fans asked her down through the years. She sat down with a co-author, and she wrote it all down. She was there on the set every day for her scenes. I think she could be believed. Donald Spoto, who was the first guy who said Hitchcock was kind of messed up, wrote two books, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock and The Dark Side of Genius. There's a book by David Thompson called The Moment of Psycho that talks about its place in the social zeitgeist in the early 60s. There's the interview book that Francois Truffaut did with Alfred Hitchcock, which talks about Psycho. There's Raymond Durdnat's BFI monograph called A Long, Hard Look at Psycho. And then there's the book this movie's based on. I've been teaching this film for 28 years. I wish I could find it. It would be a hell of a thing to put on the website. I once recorded my own audio commentary for Psycho.
Cool.
It was this thing I was doing because I was being evaluated that year, and I found a way to put myself over the soundtrack of a VHS tape.
If you find it, we'll definitely post it.
It took forever. And it's sure, like, yeah. It shows you how hard it is not to just like goof on the movie, but as it's going along, I'm trying to give facts. When they filmed the shower sequence, it took a week. It took a week to film. Does Hitchcock make that clear?
No.
That it was day after day.
It seems to have been done in an afternoon.
Okay.
Because he goes up once with the knife, and what he's really stabbing away at, though, is the images of Ed Gein, and then the guy that he's concerned is spending too much time with Alma.
Right, that he's
exercising those demons. And then she screams for real because she's afraid, and then he says, okay, cut, print. And they're done. They got it.
And they did it over and over and over. Janet Leigh in real life was self-conscious about the size of her breasts and was very nervous about the way they were going to do it, and they wound up using moleskin, which is sort of a primitive liquid latex, and they painted the front of her body with it, and that's the way they did it. More on that later. Hitchcock realized that Go ahead.
Because there's not a breast in there, right?
There is.
There is.
Well,
okay.
Like,
all right. I apologize.
This is a long road.
Okay.
Hitchcock realized that he wouldn't need Tony Perkins the week that they filmed the shower scene. Tony Perkins wanted to go to New York and start rehearsals for a play that he was going to appear in next, and Hitchcock gave him permission. So Tony Perkins flew to New York. He's thousands of miles away from California, and the film we're talking about tonight gleefully shows him playing Mother in two shots. That's not true. And to show you how much I know about this film, the stunt woman who played Mother in the shower scene is named Margot Epper. I actually know her name.
Is she of the Epper dynasty of stunt women? For real, Jeannie Epper is a famous, famous stunt woman. She used to double Linda Carter on Wonder Woman.
I thought you were joking.
I swear.
I don't know if it's true,
okay. I'm guessing,
but it was Margot Epper.
Jeannie Epper's daughter is also a stunt woman.
And they had a devil of a time because Hitchcock insisted that the bathroom be bright white with white tile. How do you hide Mom? So they had to try all these different things. And they wound up covering Margot Epper's face with black makeup so that she can improbably appear in silhouette in a bright...
Which is kind of racist. I mean...
Well, halfway through the stabbing in the original script, she breaks into sort of a minstrel show. I'm stabbing you, mammy, 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 stabbing mammy. Now, the film is interested in half of that because they do show Anthony Perkins wearing all the black makeup on his face, which makes it hard to see that it's him, because when I first watched the film, I said, oh, they got the black makeup right, and then later I saw a production still from the film that proved to me that it was Anthony Perkins. That's wrong. Hitchcock knew that Janet Leigh was very uncomfortable about the shower scene, so he hired a nude figure model, again, don't mean to throw down, but her name was Marley Renfro, and he hired her. He never used her in the film. There's not a frame of the film that has her. She walked around the set nude. A, to get people wondering about what Hitchcock was doing, and that was for the press and everything, and oh, this is going to be racy. But also, I would contend, to make Janet Leigh feel a little bit more comfortable about what she was doing. They kept filming the scene over and over, day in, day out, over and over. And obviously they wanted to make the water not be cold, and that would be torture to do that for 7 days. They made sure the water was warm and hot, and in some cases a little steamy. And they did it over and over and over again. And according to Janet Leigh's book, there was a moment where the moleskin fell off, and it was day 5, and she said, forget it, let's just get through this. Because if you watch the film with your handy remote in your hand, as the film Hitchcock brings up, there is one shot with nudity. We'll get back to that later. That's actually in the film, and it's nudity. This whole thing about the shower scene is indicative of where the film goes wrong. I will use the facts, or if it's more convenient to this preconceived notion I have, I will abandon the facts. Speaking of abandon the facts, the film suggests that the Hitchcocks had a very strange marriage, and that Alma, the former Alma Reville, was actually as great a filmmaker as Hitchcock, that she was once his boss, and that she was the power behind the throne. I know that Hitchcock really relied on her and treasured her opinion, but I would suggest this film goes one step further to suggest that she was the power behind the throne. In fact, there's one scene where they strongly imply that Alma filmed Arbogast's murder on the steps.
Yeah. I mean, the movie makes the argument, and again, because this fits into this narrative, that Helen Mirren is a woman to be contended with, and they have this unique marriage, that every good decision, or every decision that makes Psycho what it is, came from her. to kill off Janet Leigh 30 minutes into the movie instead of halfway through.
Demonstrably untrue.
To add the score to the shower scene, to cast Anthony Perkins. Every single decision comes from Alma in this movie.
Strings for the shower scene is Bernard Herrmann, and by insisting that Alma had so much to do with it, it's really a slap in the face of screenwriter Joseph Stefano. Now, in the film...
And to Hitchcock. Maybe the greatest director of all time.
In the film, Stefano's played by Ralph Macchio.
And
I've seen a lot of interviews with Stefano, because he lived a nice long life and gave a lot of interviews. And Macchio really captures what made Stefano interesting. He was an interesting character. And Stefano's given plenty of interviews about working with Hitchcock on the script and going back and forth. And Stefano would say, I would suggest this, and he was cold on that. But the minute I started going this way, Hitchcock perked up, and he was like, oh, we could do it like this. That would be more interesting than what we get, because we get Stefano for one scene, and then we never see him again.
Right.
Leading us to believe, and I believe there's a sequence where we actually see Alma working on the script.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The movie, time and again, and I was going to bring this up when you talked about it shows Anthony Perkins wearing the blackface makeup, that the screenwriters, they had all these little like pieces of trivia that they knew about Psycho or about some of the surrounding elements of Psycho, and they wanted to work those in, like to teach the audience all these neat little facts, but that they get the bigger picture wrong at every turn. And right. Maybe I could be wrong about this, and again, I'm relying on you to know these things. In 1959 or 1960, when Anthony Perkins was cast in Psycho, did everyone know that he was homosexual?
No.
And again, the movie goes out of its way because they want to teach 2012 audiences who might not know that Anthony Perkins was a homosexual, that Alma casts him, because again, Alma casts him specifically because... But he's a fellow with a secret to hide, and couldn't that be interesting? And everyone says, oh, him? I didn't realize. And they have this cute little conversation about how he's a gay man. And that was not common knowledge in 1960.
And it so diminishes Perkins' performance, because in the original film Psycho, Tony Perkins gives one of the great performances in motion picture history. It's so good, no one would ever let him play anything else.
And let's talk about that for one second. I haven't seen Anthony Perkins in many things outside of the Psycho series. I definitely haven't seen him necessarily interviewed a lot, although I did. I've heard him sing I've Got a Date with the Prettiest Girl in School. The actor who plays Anthony Perkins in the movie, whose name I don't remember, but I know he was in Cloud Atlas, and he's a talented guy.
And looks like him.
And does a dead-on impression of Norman Bates.
Yeah.
But not he's not playing Anthony Perkins. In the scene where they interview him about being cast in the movie,
right.
He's doing Norman Bates,
exactly.
Not Anthony Perkins.
And that's a problem. The other thing about the casting that I wanted to talk about was, and I'm a big Scarlett Johansson fan to begin with, I thought she was an interesting choice because I really think she did her homework. The film misuses her and doesn't use her correctly. But if you've seen... Oh, this adds to your point, that maybe she's not playing Janet Leigh, she's playing Janet Leigh in Psycho. But Janet Leigh had this very strange way of positioning her head. She had this very strange thing she did with her head, and Scarlett Johansson recreates it exactly. She was always sort of tilting it in odd ways.
She felt very miscast to me, and I don't think actors should be cast just based on how they look.
But it didn't occur to me until you made that point about the Tony Perkins Mank, that Scarlett Johansson is not playing Janet Leigh, because there's hundreds of hours. Janet Leigh lived a good long life. We've got plenty of Janet Leigh stuff, plus her book. That Scarlett Johansson is not playing Janet Leigh, she's playing Marion Crane.
Right.
The other thing about casting I wanted to point out, and here's another example where if they had just stuck to the truth, we would have had something. Jessica Biel plays Vera Miles, and it's just... she's given nothing to do.
Right.
And it's true that Hitchcock was going to try and make Vera Miles a big star, and Vera Miles chose to have a baby. She went with Hearth and Home, and Hitchcock felt betrayed. But he still had her under contract, and she owed him one more film. So she gets the thankless role of the kid sister. When Vera Miles showed up to work on Psycho, she was bald. you shave bald? Because of the previous film she was in, I believe it's the Susan Hayward film, I Want to Live, but okay. Don't quote me, I might get this wrong. Or the Snake Pit, one of those two. She was an inmate of an insane asylum for women, and they shaved her head. And so critics for the last 50 years have said, what a bad wig job on Vera Miles. And the film does mention the wig, but doesn't showing Jessica Biel showing up for work on day one, bald.
The film mentions the wig.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
But the film mentions the wig by suggesting that Hitchcock just needs to remake every woman as a blonde, and Vera Miles is shown to be a brunette, right? In this movie. So is that Jessica Biel saying, I don't want to shave my head, or is that Fox saying, you can't cast Jessica Biel and then shave her head because she's a beautiful celebrity?
And all this might be true, but to get the Hitchcock film that we would have liked,
right.
Would you agree, Vera Miles needs to show a bald?
If the goal of your movie, again, as it was originally named, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, if the goal of your movie is to actually show what it was like to make the movie Psycho, yes, absolutely. They went a different way. It's about a wacky marriage.
They went a different way. They went towards falsity.
Right.
Falsity? Norman actually says that in the film.
To once again clarify, our objections to the movie are not necessarily that they make up facts, although that's certainly part of it. It's also just a bad movie all around.
Yes. If you're going to make so much stuff up, what you end up with should be much better than this.
Right.
And the truth would have been better than this.
Right. Either better lies or the truth.
Here's another problem I had with the film, and it might come down to litigation.
Okay.
Where the fuck is Hitchcock's daughter?
Yeah.
The Hitchcocks had a daughter.
Yeah.
Her name was Patricia. She was an actress. She's still alive.
Right.
And she's in Psycho. She plays a part in Psycho.
Right.
You can really see how that doesn't fit.
Yeah. Yeah.
At all. And if you want to talk about truth versus lies and lies versus truth, there's a moment in this film. There's one moment in this film. One. That's actually pretty great. But the film that surrounds it ruins it. At one point, at a low point, the Hitchcock Mank, played by Anthony Hopkins under pounds of makeup, looks at a shelf full of pictures. And as we've come to expect in movies like this, they've all been heavily photoshopped to make it look like Helen Mirren and Anthony Hopkins are Hitchcock and Alma at various points. And then, for some demented reason, as we track across the pictures, we come to a real picture. A real picture of Hitchcock and Alma. And boy, is this film, boy, is this picture famous. Hitchcock's directing. I forget what film it is. You see the camera operator. You see Hitchcock way down front, and he's directing. It's a silent film, so he can shout. And the look on his face. Do you remember this moment in the film?
No, I don't.
Oh, my God, you can find it on Google. It's a famous picture. He's leaning forward with one finger. He's pointing at something, and he's obviously shouting at the actors, and his face is so focused on what he's doing, and behind him, Alma's standing there holding the script and sort of looking intense as well. And I get the impression that wasn't posed, that wasn't staged, that was actually taken on the set. And for one moment, we get the truth. After a whole bunch of Photoshop nonsense, if you're going to photo, why would you do that?
I have a feeling that everybody involved with the movie had hoped that this would score a bunch of awards nominations because the screenplay is certainly geared towards that. It's made, you know, it's about movies, which the Academy loves. It's made about a beloved filmmaker. Helen Mirren is fine. She's good in everything, and
here's the other problem. Why do we bend over backwards to put Hopkins under pounds of makeup and a fat suit and all these other things?
Helen Mirren play Helen Mirren.
And then Helen Mirren plays Alma. Alma was this tiny, plain woman.
I don't know.
What? I don't get it. Here's other things that upset me.
Well, I was just going to say that I thought Anthony Hopkins was bad in the movie.
Yes.
And although, it's not just the pounds of makeup.
Although,
I thought he sort of worked on a voice, he put on a fat suit, and then his performance is just lifeless.
And there's some people who've been liking the performance, but here's where the film can trick you. Because I love Hitchcock, because I hold him so close to my heart. There's a scene that when I watched it, I thought it worked.
Do not say the scene that I...
Oh, you know exactly the scene. But hold on, there's hope for me.
It's the worst.
I was driving home, and I was thinking, no, that's bullshit. And then, every day since I saw it, I'm like, why did I get carried away at a successful screening of Psycho? He's shown in the lobby, listening to the shower scene, and he begins to do this demented cross between an orchestra conductor and a ballerina, and it's like he's directing the audience to scream.
Because again, the filmmakers decided that Hitchcock is this master manipulator, he's this conductor of the audience's emotions, he knows exactly how to play an audience, which is evident in his films. We don't need to see that literalized on screen by showing him in the lobby conducting the audience to scream. And I know that the movie builds up to that moment, and I'm positive that everyone involved was in love with that moment.
I was suckered in.
Ooh.
I now recognize that it's ludicrous. And again, maybe we love movies too much, but in this
bloated
film, why can't we actually see them in the editing room, watch something, make a small change, we see what a big difference the small change makes, and there, that's right. What he did.
Right.
What he did was very technical.
Instead, it's that the shower scene's not working, Alma says, add some music, and now it's fixed.
And that never happened. Here are other reasons where you can make your blood boil on your drive home from Evanston. The film suggests that the first preview of Psycho was a disaster. This is to give us the end of the second act behind the music low point.
I'll be ruined.
And then we can turn it into Rocky. It's going to take a montage, montage, and Alma shows you the way to go now. Never happened. Never happened. The film strongly implies that Alma directed Arbogast's murder because Hitchcock was feeling under the weather or just looking for sympathy and faking it. Never happened. Because earlier in time, Saul Bass, who designed the opening credits and who did the storyboards for the shower scene, after Hitchcock died, he began to claim that Hitchcock let him film the shower scene. That on the fateful day, Hitchcock said, go ahead. Janet Leigh was there every day that she's on screen. And Janet Leigh said, no one, no one, no one directed one frame other than Mr. Hitchcock. The film suggests that from the beginning, the film was having problems with the censorship board, that Hitchcock had to submit the script and they had a whole bunch of qualms. That's true.
Okay.
To the extent that when Hitchcock was finished editing the shower scene, he took that over to them to get them to pass that as sort of a preemptive strike. And then the film suggests that Hitchcock was run so ragged by the censor board and that the censor board had a problem with the opening scene between Janet Leigh and John Gavin.
Right.
That in this bullshit movie, Hitchcock invites the head of the censor board to come back to the studio. He reassembled the actors and rebuilt the set and said, you direct it. Right. You tell me what to do. And the censor guy, who I guess was a coward, never showed. Never happened.
That was his big concession. That's
never happened.
And but what a huge invention.
Here's what really happened. And what really happened, as we know, is much better. Hitchcock finishes the fine editing of the shower sequence, takes it over to the review board, takes it over to the censor board. There's seven guys. They watch it. When the lights come up, four of them have seen nudity. That's because there's nudity in the sequence. Three of them have not seen any nudity. Their conclusion? Take out the nudity. Hitchcock went back to the studio, didn't touch the film, put it on a different reel, brought it back, said, can we watch it again? He's showing them the exact same cut. The lights come up. The four that saw nudity no longer see nudity. The three that didn't see the nudity now see nudity. Hitchcock throws up his hands, says, what do you want me to do? They let it go.
And again, I've seen a lot of movies. I know something about movies, so maybe I'm giving everyone too much credit. I feel like that's kind of a well-known fact, that he resubmitted the exact same thing and got it through without changing anything. So again, maybe it's not as well-known as I would think, because obviously this movie was not made for people who like movies at all, I don't think.
And here's my biggest proof of who this movie was made for. The film posits something of a love triangle, where Alma, who is not feeling appreciated, starts to help a very unspecified writer. Most of these people are dead. And you told me that that's Tony Perkins and that's Janet Leigh.
Right.
So why does this screenwriter have a made-up name and is played by Danny Huston? So she agrees to help him with his script. So now she feels useful. And, of course, everyone in the audience except the 2-year-old baby who's asleep is saying, well, no, he's seducing her or he's using her to get to Hitchcock. And this becomes a thing. And there's a beach house. And none of that ever happened.
Right.
It's complete bullshit.
Right. To add drama to the... Were they just concerned that the making of Psycho was not interesting enough? Because... Maybe then don't use that as a jumping off point for a movie.
Were they really concerned? You just said it better than I was going to. Were they really concerned that what this movie is about
won't work as a movie?
Is not what it should be about.
Right. So let's make up a guy and add some marital issues. Again, it's hinted at every once in a while that Hitchcock is unnaturally obsessed with his leading ladies, and he's got all these headshots of these blonde women, and Alma knows about it, but they don't speak
and
of
she,
it.
No, but she at one point says, your fantasy romances.
Right.
Which, again, is an attempt by this film to smooth things over and say, oh, see, she knew the truth. Besides this nonsensical thing we were talking about where he's conducting the audience like a spastic in a windstorm. There's actually one other moment that I like.
Okay.
Let's see what you think.
Okay.
It's very brief. He's on the lot outside the door of his office.
Okay.
And he looks across the little road, and there's a young actor sort of wooing a young actress. They're there, and they share a moment. They kiss or they hug or something. And the film strongly implies that Hitchcock makes all these movies about these people, but that's something he's never been able to have because he is not a handsome man, and he's a man of size. And I actually thought that worked and wasn't hitting us on the head with a shovel.
Sure.
And that the film needed more of that.
Right. Sure, yeah.
It's less than 30 seconds. Don't go to this movie just to see an over... made-up Anthony Hopkins making moony eyes at a
young lover. I'll say one positive thing about the movie. I liked the photography. I don't think it necessarily fit the subject matter. It didn't fit the period. It didn't fit the making of Psycho, because, again, Psycho is a movie shot by a TV crew in stark black and white, and this movie is very saturated. The color is very... It has a sort of a stylized look. I liked the way it looked, even if I didn't feel like it was right for this material.
And I liked the way it looked, too, and I was especially fond of the art direction.
Yeah.
That I think the early 60s were a real cool time to be alive in terms of architecture and fashion and clothing and cars. And like we see with Mad Men, for instance, it's really nice when they try to recreate that with some sense of accuracy. And I really thought it looked good, but again, to what end? One more thing about the ending. There's this wonderful ending that will let you pat yourself on the back for realizing something everyone knows.
Oh my gosh.
That Hitchcock is standing on his lawn, and I think he's thinking about what his next movie should be.
Well, all of a sudden he's addressing the audience
because
directly.
He did at the beginning, too.
But you can't just do it here. These bookends. The movie has all these ideas that it doesn't know what to do with. It sort of throws them all together. Consistency where... sometimes he'll narrate the movie directly to the camera, and sometimes he won't.
It comes across half-assed, so he's sitting
there. Like a reshoot, almost. Because he used to do this on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, so we need the movie to begin and end with him speaking directly to the audience.
It very much comes across as a reshoot. So Hitchcock is sitting there, and I believe he's opining that the problem with having a big success is what do you do to follow it up? And a big black Bird on cue lands on his shoulder.
I mean, literally lands.
And at that point, the bird lands on his shoulder. He takes a beat and he says, "Good evening." And we go to black and we have a pretty shitty ending to a shitty film. But here's, man, talk about letting people leave the theater wanting to scream. That's not where the film ends. The bird flies away. We cut to a long shot and Hitchcock walks back up the lawn to his wife.
God, I forgot that. I'm thinking it really does end with the bird flying.
No, and in that last shot, it's like, no, because remember, the wifey is very important, and oh, whatever. Awful film in almost every way. Would you agree, though, that Birdlands beat Good Evening, Blackout, is a better ending than him walking back up the lawn?
Yes.
To his wife.
Yes. Having said that, I hate the bird landing because I just feel like it's trying to give the audience credit for something that like you said, everyone knows. Are we supposed to be impressed with ourselves for getting the, oh, because he makes the birds next? Of course. Why are you beating us over the head with this? You're trying to treat it as this little sly joke. Meanwhile, a giant fucking bird lands on his shoulder. I thought for sure a bird was going to shit on his shoulder. That he's standing there, I don't know what I'm going to do next. Bird poop, I'll think of something. I mean, that's offensive, but I it's way less in your face than the giant bird landing on his shoulder.
From Mel Brooks.
Oh, my God.
So back to the point I was making at the beginning.
Don't see Hitchcock.
As we discovered months and months and months ago, I wrote a column about A Beautiful Mind, a film about another genius, where we find out that people have a real hard time wrapping their minds around genius. So we have this misbegotten thing where they want us to feel comfortable about genius by saying, oh, it was mostly his wife. They were married. You know what that is. You know what a marriage is. And also, all this disturbing stuff, these fantasy romances with your 8x10s. Well, no, it was more than that. But recently on HBO, they had another movie about Hitchcock with Toby Jones.
Which I have not watched.
Called The Girl, which you shouldn't. The Girl makes Hitchcock look like a masterpiece. And The Girl is more evidence of what I'm talking about. Hitchcock was a genius. I think I can demonstrate that on an Edge-a-Sketch. And The Girl takes the other tactic, which I also hate. Oh, Hitchcock was a genius? No, he was a dangerous lunatic. Oh, look how ugly. And that film just wallows in the slime.
Okay.
I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But again, we're talking about art. And it's that middle place that's hard to nail.
Yes.
It's easy to do Hitchcock as a domestic comedy.
Yes.
As this film does.
Yes.
It's real easy.
Yes.
At one point, Toby Jones walks into Tippi Hedren's dressing room and the girl, you will be available to have sex with me whenever I say.
So he's Eric the actor?
I want all the ham. I feel bad for what Tippi Hedren went through, and I believe what she says. But again, it's that gray area, it's that ambiguous middle. And if anything, Ed Wood is very comfortable in that ambiguous gray area.
But again, Ed Wood has an idea of exactly what it wants to be about this very eccentric, unusual guy who doesn't have a lot of talent but a lot of enthusiasm, who builds a family of quote-unquote freaks around him, and
but
that's what the movie's
he
about.
He made the films he wanted to make, Say What You Want, and we've done an entire podcast on Plan 9. Say What You Want, it's not the worst film ever made.
No, it's not.
That's Dark Shadow.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Don't see Hitchcock.
Good evening.